You're listening to All the Best. I'm Michael Bryden, and today we're destroying Australian cities and towns in all sorts of fictional, terrifying ways. We're ducking for cover and stocking up on canned goods. We're digging bunkers and investing in solar panels. Yeah, that's right. This episode is all about the apocalypse. I'm joined in the studio by supervising producer Leona Hamid. Hey Leona, how did this episode come about?
The idea came from always seeing LA and New York and cities like that in America, and Tokyo being destroyed in films and in books. And I wondered whether something happens to your brain when you see your own city destroyed on film, and whether Melburnians are lacking something because they never see their city destroyed on film.
So you wanted to bring the idea of the apocalypse to Australia?
Yeah. Having said that, there actually was like quite a bit of apocalypse fiction based in Melbourne, we found out. But I suspected that either seeing your own city destroyed on film had the effect of creating a space for people to talk about actual threats to human existence, or maybe it would just make people complacent about those threats. I thought maybe it would have an effect on people's capacity to react in a situation that was like an apocalypse.
So it's really about fiction talking to reality.
Yeah, it's about the relationship between reality and imagination. And it's about whether fiction informs reality or whether reality informs fiction. What I thought was that there would be two separate entities. There would be reality and there would be imagination. And one of them would have an effect on the other. But when I was talking to Keith Jacobs from the University of Tasmania, he's a professor in social studies, he really reframed it as reality and imagination are inextricably linked.
We have this version that there's reality and there's imagination. We think of fiction as somehow separate from reality. And in a sense, that's probably a misunderstanding, because I think to make sense of the world, we have to use our imagination. Fiction, to me, and the imagination is actually closely linked to reality. So the gap between reality and the imagination is probably a false one. I've always kind of find that the most interesting things which provide the most insights about the kind of human condition is often people who write in literature. You know, often you kind of read the story, but at the same time you're seeing it through the filter of your own life. And I think the imagination provides us with a space to confront very difficult things.
We're going to hear a bit more from Keith later on.
So in this first story, we're going to have a look at a Melbourne that has been destroyed by climate change, right?
Yeah. So one of our producers, Emma Kewen, had a walk around Flemington with Jane Rawson. She wrote the book A Wrong Turn at the Office of Unmade Lists, which reimagines Melbourne destroyed by climate change.
I've been imagining Melbourne crumbling lately. I've just read Jane Rawson's novel A Wrong Turn at the Office of Unmade Lists about a post-climate change city in which all systems have broken down. It ain't pretty, but it is concerning. So I met her in Flemington to look at some of the buildings that she destroyed in her book and work out how we might cope post-climate change.
My name is Jane Rawson, and I'm a writer. We're in the Duda Gala Hotel, which has got much fancier than the last time I was here.
Look, there's art on the ceilings.
Yeah, there's art on the ceilings. It's kind of cool. I destroyed the Duda Gala Hotel. I'm not sure why I really took against this place in particular. But I think it was too many times when I used to live just around the corner, and this is a real sort of after races hangout, so there are always a lot of really drunk people here who are really annoying. It's set in 2030, my novel. I was interested in thinking about both what the effect would be on Melbourne of a changing climate, of hotter temperatures, and also, you know, more unpredictable wet and dry weather, but that combined with a government that had pulled away from providing social services, wasn't interested in supporting society generally anymore, and that wasn't really investing in infrastructure much. The main character is Caddy. She had previously lived in Yarraville, in my old house, and had lost her house, her husband, her adorable little cat, in an industrial accident when the big oil tanks down in Yarraville exploded. She's in a state of fairly deep depression, having lost everything she loves, and so doesn't care that much about herself or her future, and, you know, it's just getting by, basically, and trying to enjoy the little things life has, like gin. I think it's mostly where you're getting data every day about things and then trying to extrapolate in your brain what that might be like in real life. I just wanted to use that stuff that was in my head. And it seemed like it could be a bit rough.
Just a bit rough.
A little bit rough.
Jane has worked as an environment journalist and, as well as writing this novel, is also currently researching a book on how we can survive climate change day to day. She looks pretty closely at the little things that can go wrong.
I think for most people it's very abstract. It's far off in the future and it's far off in space to most people as well. They think about, oh, this is going to be terrible for people in Bangladesh, or, you know, this will be terrible for species in the desert, and this might be terrible for my great-grandchildren, who I can't even imagine yet, so I feel a bit bad about it. But most of my friends who are, you know, left-leaning, Greens voting, aware people, a lot of them are science communicators. When I talk to them about this book, look of horror they start getting on their face, and the questions they start asking that are, but not us, right?
What are your tips? Can you give any away for climate change survival?
For climate change, I think the main thing we're discovering, we're only halfway through researching this book, is be in a strong community. Have good friends, have a relationship with your neighbours, keep in touch with your family if you have a good relationship with your family, because whatever happens, what will happen is fairly unpredictable, and you can try and figure it out to the nth degree and adapt to it, but you won't know what's going to happen. The most important thing is, if something bad happens to you, that someone else cares about you and can help you out. So, you know, if your house burns down, there's someone who'll let you stay in their spare room. Or if you're short on food and they have food, they'll share it with you.
In the book, Melbourne is full of shanty towns inside train stations where homelessness is a given and there's no infrastructure that can keep up to speed. Shops are empty, soldiers are on the ground, and food and water supplies are just pipe dream.
Well, when I wrote this, it was quite a few years back, you might remember, when it was really hot there for a while and a lot of the train tracks buckled and the trains stopped because their air conditioning was inadequate. I started thinking about what would it be like if the trains largely didn't run at all. I reckon it would be better to be in a place where there are a lot of trees, for a leafy suburb. Trees create a nice microclimate that keeps things generally cooler no matter how hot it is. So otherwise I would say Footscray, but Footscray's terrible for trees.
Here's the thing I'm really worried about. Is Melbourne a city that's made for any disaster, or is it the worst case scenario?
You hear all the time politicians and business people and stuff saying, yes, we believe in the climate science, we know something needs to be done, but that's kind of where it ends.
That's it, yeah.
And you're like, no, I don't think you do. I don't know if you don't understand it or you don't want to come to grips with it because it's politically really difficult. But I think as far as a city that is vulnerable to a climate apocalypse, Melbourne's a great one. It's really there are so many options for it, from bushfire on the city fringe to sea level rise and all those bayside suburbs to, you know, the incredibly sprawling city that's really hard to navigate without a functional transport system. There's so many opportunities.
Thanks to Emma Kewen for that story, and to Jane Rawson for showing her around dystopian Flemington. So you talk to a lot of people about apocalypses.
A lot of people hadn't thought about it at all, but then as I was recording a podcast for another show I work on, I was interviewing Zora Sanders, who edits Meanjin, and I was telling her about this topic we were doing on All the Best. And she was so excited about it because she thinks about apocalypses all the time.
It just pops into my head at random times in the day. Like, I'll be grocery shopping and I'll think, oh, but if I got two of those, I'd be slightly more ready for the apocalypse. Some weird television program, and this girl wished that everyone in the world would get turned into flies other than her. And it happened, and everyone got turned into flies. And so she just got to walk around on her own and hang out and, like, go to the mall and, you know, try on clothes and go into other people's houses and snoop around. And everyone was just turned into flies. And then eventually, of course, in the TV show, she got sad and wished everyone back. But I would never wish everyone back. That is my ultimate dream situation. Everyone is gone, but all the infrastructure is left perfectly intact. And, you know, I'll get in a car and I'll drive it until the petrol runs out, and then I'll get in another car and I'll drive all the way to far north Queensland, and then I'll get in a boat and I'll get a boat over to Indonesia, and I'll just sort of island hop till I get to mainland Asia, and I can just spend the rest of my life just driving around. There'll be plenty of canned food and stuff to find, because no one else is competing with me for it. I am literally just the last person on earth. I think that what is so attractive about the apocalypse is that it's the worst thing that can happen. It's the apocalypse. It is literally the worst thing that can happen. And once that's happened, what really do you have left to worry about?
So Zora sounds pretty ready for the apocalypse, but we're sitting here in our studio in the middle of Melbourne CBD.
Feels a little bit like a bunker.
And you can't really see what's going on outside. We got to wondering what could be happening out there and how an apocalypse could come about.
I spoke to a bunch of people trying to answer this question exactly, and one of them was Professor Joseph Siracusa. Anything could be happening outside the studio right now.
There are no hospitals. There are no burn beds. I tried to get a number of the body bags that were available to put the dead in. And they only got about 2,500 in a storage in Canberra. There's no place to put the bodies, and the buildings are hundreds of metres high in ruins. All the landmarks are gone.
This is Professor Joseph Siracusa. Joe, he created a nuclear scenario for Melbourne to see how we would deal with a potential fallout. He's telling me why we're doomed.
So I got together with some colleagues at the human security group that I was working with here, and we developed a couple scenarios, and then we crunched the numbers through Department of Defense computers in the United States. We had a young man there who charged us some money to see what actually happens. And so we planted it in a van at the corner of Swanston and Collins Street, right across from the old Chanel or the Westin Hotel. You can pull up a car there very easily. So we had some people assemble this thing and blow it up early afternoon. Now, between 12 noon and 2 p.m. on a summer day, there are 250,000 Melburnians in the city walking around, getting the fresh air, finding lunch, cup of coffee, whatever it is. And these people would be the ones who'd be hit. Also, we picked a day in which Parliament was in session. So on the day of this blast, around 2 in the afternoon, we have the ability to take out the state government, federal police, and all the agencies, plus the local government. And so you get a picture of the chaos that might ensue.
Joe is a professor in human security and international diplomacy and discipline head of global studies at RMIT University. He's also a specialist in American politics and global security. His office is on Swanston Street in the Melbourne CBD. When I arrive, he tells me he'll be on the news later tonight. About an hour ago, he says, an American journalist was beheaded by ISIS. I have only a basic understanding of what ISIS is at this point. The media want Joe to speculate on how America will react, but it feels like unverified information still. I don't know who or what he's talking about, and I feel as though I should. 24 hours later, it's impossible not to know.
James Foley.
Jim Foley.
James Foley.
Jim was a journalist.
The pictures of James Foley's murder are all over the internet and the front pages of the tabloids. He shows me the books he's most well known for: Globalization and Human Security, Nuclear Weapons, A Very Short Introduction, The Politics of Nuclear Weaponry. I guess he's framing our conversation for me, but I wonder whether he's also trying to establish his credentials, like he's used to being thought of as a sensationalist.
With a nuclear weapon, more than 95% of the energy initially released is in the form of intense light. And this creates a heat blast of about 4 times the temperature of the center of the sun. And the air that originally occupies the area within and surrounding the fireball is compressed into a wall of superheated gas. This in turn compresses the surrounding air and forms an enormous blast wave. And at the end of the first second, the shock wave produced would destroy all the landmarks in Melbourne, including the National Gallery of Victoria. Flinders Station would be gone, Parliament House, and the incomparable State Library of Victoria. Nothing inside the ring would be recognizable.
Los Angeles and New York, Tokyo. These cities see themselves destroyed on screen and in literature all the time. But Australian cities? Rarely on the same scale. Melbourne is rarer still. I wonder, what effect does it have on you to see your own city destroyed? To see the places you live in and love and frequent crushed to dust or swamped in water or blown up or chemically wiped out? I emailed as many sci-fi experts as I could, and then I emailed global conflict experts in the secret hope that they would be extracurricular apocalypse nerds. That is how I found Joe.
For me?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, come along. Joe Syracuse.
Nice to meet you, Amirina.
I'm definitely a bit intimidated by Joe. Firstly, because I have real trouble with the word nuclear. And I don't want to say it wrong at a nuclear expert. And also, he has a Chicago accent. He sounds like an expert. He is an expert. But I'm finding the things he's saying really hard to feel panicked about.
So here we have this beautiful city is reduced to ruins. You got 84,000 bodies rotting in the center of it. And you'll get this paralysis and this silence will fall over the place. Now you've got tens of thousands of Melburnians who are homeless. There's no water because the generators aren't working for the water. Electricity's out. You know, it doesn't take much to paralyze a nation if the water goes out. You ever seen these science fiction movies where they just turn off the electricity for 2 hours in the movie and it degenerates? But there wouldn't be a lot of help from the federal government because they're limited.
So, how prepared is Melbourne for a nuclear terrorist attack? It seems like the answer is not at all. Nowhere near ready.
They'll all say they have a plan, but they don't have a plan. And I think the reason they don't have a plan, I think for a nation like Australia, it's almost beyond the realm of the imagination to figure out what would you do next. I mean, it's beyond the collective realm of the imagination.
When I arrive at Melbourne Central Station to meet Joe, emerging from the station into the daylight feels strange and eerie. It's cool and still, like the calm before a storm. The first thing I see are police officers on horses lined up along Latrobe Street. There's a protest against government policy. One side of a large banner condemns Christopher Pyne and education cuts. The other demands that Manus Island be closed down. Protesters are chanting. Activists sprint past me towards the library. As I cross the road, a woman thrusts a pamphlet into my hands. It says that the US and the Australian government are part of a worldwide monetary capitalist conspiracy to the detriment of humans everywhere. We must revolt. What it feels like to me is one of those scenes in a dystopian sci-fi movie. Human life is almost totally destroyed. We've all turned into cannibals and we see a flashback to a recognisable past where everything kicked off and everyone realised how fucked they were. It feels like I'm in a movie in that flashback. Like this is the start of something big and inevitable. When I mentioned this to Leone, she says something really interesting. The reason why I felt like I was in a movie was because I had suspended my disbelief. I was tuning into the parts of my environment that fit into the narrative of a sci-fi movie.
And I think it's sort of part of what we're doing here in a strange way is that there's a sense that with modernity and our whole system, we learn to attune ourselves to things. There's a sense of attunement or attention. So at that time, your sense of attention was almost like condensed.
Dr. Leone Cooper works at Monash University and specialises in screen theory and practice, science fiction, apocalyptic and predictive theories and practices. She's in the middle of a project for Equity and Diversity Week called Brave New World. Students will be creating and discovering artifacts from parallel or future worlds. It's a mix between performance art and geocaching. They're all wearing biohazard suits. We talk while we walk around the uni. You'll hear the automatic doors of the uni library in the background of this.
Danger, do not enter tape, separating the room into two spaces.
It's a bit like when you watch a film, we're just talking about those rules that sci-fi have. Like, if you just consider this for a moment, you know, what if?
Yeah.
I think today is that part of the film where you go to people, what if? So our 3D printer has finished printing, because it is very anthropomorphic to me. I do anthropomorphize this printer. So this is the filament that feeds into it.
Mm-hmm.
FLA, and then we just have our low-tech typewriter over here, and at the moment what one of the participants is doing is she's transcribing that book, which was put in a time capsule in 1963 to be opened in 2063, and this is associated with the NASA endeavor, so it's like astronauts and politicians particularly. So that's a copy of that book, and it has to go back to the
talking to Leonie. I have a moment of realization. The biggest threat to human life is arguably climate change. Lack of action on climate change is sometimes said to be because of an inability by scientists to communicate a message. That's what writers and artists and filmmakers can do. I think back to what Keith Jacobs said. Remember him?
I'm very, very hopeful. I mean, I see artists and people who write and people who draw and paint as kind of people who have great, are seers. They're able to see things in a different way to how we, most of us, live our lives, which is to kind of focus on the mundane and the everyday. So I'm very, I think, in a sense, if we are going to kind of create a better future for ourselves, it's the people who are going to show us how to do it are those people who are working in the kind of creative spaces.
The people who have a hand in shaping the future, those people are inspired by and shaped by the future shown to them by sci-fi writers. The future is sci-fi. Sci-fi is the future. Politicians can deal with big, terrible, incomprehensible threats if they have the imagination for it. The future materialises in the way it does because of sci-fi. It's not just a weird coincidence. Here's Joe again.
I think it was about 1910. H.G. Wells wrote a book that foreshadowed tanks and nuclear bombs. And as a result of that book, and I think it's 1910, 1912, the man writes him an 8-page fan letter. And that man is Winston Churchill.
We are the masters of our fate.
And he and Wells become buddies until Wells dies in 1946. And he's always interested in Wells' take about what the future is going to look like. This idea of futurology, and it's a very serious study in many places about what things are going to look like and how they're going to work, begins with science fiction writers. The people in science fiction, they almost always get it right. You know, they're 50, 60 years out, but they almost always get it right.
That the task which has been set us is not above our strength. That its pangs and toils are not beyond our endurance. As long as we have faith in our cause and an unconquerable willpower, salvation will not be denied us.
One of the things that Joe said that really struck me was that in the event of apocalypse, the places that we'll get our communication and information from, they're community radio stations.
And community radio would be telling people what to do. Those would be the wavelengths that would be open to the ordinary guy.
So you can live out the rest of your days drinking bottled water, eating beans from a can, and listening to All the Best.
So you may have a role to play. And I can assure you no one has prepared you for the day.
This episode of All the Best was produced at Syn Radio in Melbourne in association with FBI Radio in Sydney, Triple R in Melbourne and 4ZZZ in Brisbane. Thanks to all the producers who contributed to this episode, Emma Kewen and supervising producer Leona Hamid. Our features executive producers are Heidi Pett and Jess O'Callaghan. Our community coordinator is Pip Rasmussen. Our executive producer is Jordana Caputo. And I'm Michael Bryden. All the Best is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation.
We're going to end with some apocalyptic fiction from Yuki Iwama, Erin Handley, John Back, and Deborah Kane.
Thanks to everyone who imagined their city being destroyed for us. More of their city's fictional apocalypse can be read on our website, allthebestradio.com.
The mossy green of the dam wall blanched white, made brittle like snowflakes. The water dwindled low, lapping against sediment cement. It was silently sucked from beneath. When the water left the stone containers, the fenced-in backyard pools, the snaked banks of the pier, it was evaporated out of grass blades, the magnolia petals curled brown. Then the moisture was sapped out of skin. It didn't feel like thirsting, she thought. Just the slow and persistent pressure, starting at her neck, pinching down vertebrae. She sent all of her thoughts to the balls of her feet, leaning forward, tottering on the cusp before a drag of 1 foot, weighted as if it was waterlogged, forward, carving a dark scar through the chipwood at Anzac Park. In her throat, a dry cry caught. But the bodies around her were already flattened, folded up like paper, a country town afflicted by mass paralysis.
The teddy bear had a red bow tie and black button eyes. She was walking, but had forgotten where she'd been. Few memories can be made when one has only been alive for a matter of days. All she had was a single picture in her mind of a blue house on a small hill, and that was where she was headed. The tiny teddy wandered through cracking cotton fields into a dusty country town. As the bear ambled on, the main street peeled back. After a great many little steps, the teddy came upon an op shop tucked away behind a chapel. The door handle crumbled on her padded touch. It seemed the store itself would collapse if she sneezed in the wrong direction.
It's an ugly sneer in the cracked earth, the black water from the Yarra River streaming in through the jagged teeth. The city used to be in constant motion before the great earthquake, an oiled dance of machines and limbs, but now it writhes at the bottom of the crevasse like a snake in heat.
The magpies in their gums, like thrones, saw their chance. They swooped low in black-white streaks. When the humans did not fling their hands up to save their heads, the birds became more brazen. They looped down, close, clipping at the clefts of pink ears and tangling their claws in hair.
But the house was not well. Blue strips of paint were slipping from the weatherboard. A puppy stumbled off the porch, dazed and losing breath. It crumpled past, collapsing into the pebbled. As the two toys turned, the landscape emerged. Down the hill, in the same path that Teddy had walked, cracked pavement and smouldering ruins lay in her wake. And there, from the base of the hill, three new paths of destruction were being forged.
The smell of molten bricks and smoking steel drives you from the edge as you look down, weeping from the acridity. If it were any other day, you would be weeping for the lost city, but today's your last and you find nothing inside.